It was proposed that if tentative approval is given to moving Iqaluit to a new site, this be effective as of January 1954, when all present activities, when all building activities, rather, at the present site would be discontinued. At that time, a memorandum was sent to the Cabinet recommending approval in principle be given to the move of Iqaluit to a more suitable site, and that construction of the present site be discontinued, and that the Department of Northern Affairs and National Resources be responsible for handling arrangements for the move. In June 1959, Inuvik, as it was then being called, was a construction site for which the Department of Northern Affairs was expected to provide services and maintenance by September 1959. Correction, September 1960. When the school, hostels, and a number of warehouses, some living accommodations, the powerhouse, and the garage would be completed. In April 1958, it became apparent that opposition to the name Iqaluit for East 3 would require another term, and such names as Arctic City and Nanuk were proposed. Local people being solicited for their views. In October 1957, concern was expressed over the springing up of shacks at East 3. Including tent frames. These were being constructed by people employed on the site who had no other accommodations available. It was hoped that these would be temporary structures. This was quite in contravention of the policy in effect in 1957 that no private building would go on at the site in that year. However, since these were temporary buildings, it was thought that vigilance was the best policy. In August 1956, a proposed building bylaw for the new town of Iqaluit was prepared by Ottawa, and regulations for fire protection had also been prepared. The Anglican hostel at New Iqaluit was ready for occupancy in September 1959. The two hostels that were to open September 1, 1959 would send children to a new 25-classroom federal school. As of January 1959, the Anglican residential school in Iqaluit held 106 pupils, 10 beginners, 18 in the first grade, 24 in the second, 8 in the third, 20 in the fourth, 8 in the fifth, 7 in the sixth, 5 in the seventh, 3 in the eighth, 3 in the ninth. Of these, 8 were white, 13 were Indian, and 85 were Eskimo. Immaculate Conception Residential School in 1958 had 90 pupils. Those figures, 90, would apply to the winter of 1959. That is February, January of 1959. In March, it was feared that not enough students would be on hand to attend the hostel in September 1959. The hope was to have at least 400 in the two hostels. I see from a telegram that the new school in Iqaluit has 30 classrooms, including special rooms, and not 25 as previously stated. The present three-classroom school will be discontinued, reducing new rooms to be furnished to 28. In May 1959, attention was given to the problem of recruiting children in the central and western Arctic for the new hostels and schools. Each community presented special problems. For example, in Cambridge Bay, virtually no Eskimo live in outlying camps, except those who come from Bathurst Inlet. At Bathurst Inlet, a good time to pick up the children would be ship time, when about 30 or 40% of the population flocks into the trading post, and the children could then be picked up by float plane. Other communities served by the schools are Spence Bay, Joe Haven, Chantry, Chantry Inlet, which is described as the most isolated Eskimo group in Canada, with very little contact with the outside. And the children there would be picked up at the mouth of Back River. Perry River, that's it. There are also Eskimo who come from Contwoyto Lake, but these people usually trade into Bathurst Inlet. However, there is a radio station at Contwoyto, if that's the pronunciation. Until two or three years prior to 1959, all recruiting for mission residential schools was done by the churches, with few restrictions placed on the churches by the department. In more recent times, the department has laid down criteria for the admission of children to the schools, but the churches continue to assume responsibility for recruitment. These criteria include residing in a community that is not within commuting distance of a school where the child's grade level is being taught. The exception to this rule is in the case of so-called welfare admissions. Then the superintendent of child welfare may place children in residential schools, provided that he has the custody of those children by virtue of a court order. In 1959, out of 246 children in the two mission schools at Iqaluit, 57 were there on welfare grounds, and another 40 had been admitted by the churches, but no grants had been paid for them because their admission was not approved. Then there were 28 welfare applications pending. In 1959, it was the intention to limit the activities of the day school at Iqaluit from grades 1 to 6, and students in senior grades would be sent to Inuvik. So already at this period, there was indication that Iqaluit would continue as a separate settlement. In 1959, there were 5 recruitment areas for the Inuvik student residences. Region 1, the coastal area, between Pin 3 and Spence Bay. Region 2, the coastal area from Pin C westward. Region 3, the Mackenzie River Basin south of Inuvik. Region 4, the Iqaluit area. And Region 5, the Contwoyto Lake area. In early August, it was estimated that 175 children would move into the newly completed Anglican hostel, 70 from the Eklavik area, 80 from Tuktoyaktuk, and 25 from Cambridge Bay, and that 115 children would move into the Roman Catholic school, 60 from Eklavik, 50 from Tuktoyaktuk, and 5 from Cambridge Bay. And the area itself, served by the hostel, contained a child population between the ages of 5 and 14 years of 1,201 children, of whom 551 were in day school attendance on March 31st, 1959. These 551 children, together with certain other children above grade 6 in certain schools, gave a potential hostel population of 742 children, to be divided between Inuvik and the Fort McPherson hostel. Apparently in 1959, 172 children attended the Roman Catholic residential school at Eklavik, and 106 students attended the Anglican residential school at Eklavik. Meanwhile, grades 1 to 6 only were being taught at the following places: Tuktoyaktuk, Eklavik, Arctic Red River, Fort Good Hope, Norman Wells, Fort Norman, and Fort Franklin, are a total of 92 students in those places. That 92 means 92 students from those places in grades 7 to 9, not the total number of students in those. And those 92 students would be potentials for the Inuvik hostel. The Inuvik school would open with 24 standard classrooms and such special facilities as an auditorium, gymnasium, shops, a library, a home economic laboratory, social studies classroom, a guidance suite, and guidance classroom. The school is built in a T formation, with facilities used in common housed in the stem of the T. The west wing houses 10 classrooms for Roman Catholic pupils, and the east wing has 14 classrooms for Protestant pupils. Apparently the curriculum is based on the Alberta curriculum, and there is a training program in homemaking for girls and shop work for boys. Each hostel has a service area with offices, recreation rooms, medical rooms, laundry, kitchen, students' dining rooms, staff bedrooms, and common rooms, student study rooms, boys' and girls' dormitories, each with washrooms. There are infirmaries, and there's a lounge and a supervisor's quarters. The department was most anxious that the hostels be filled to capacity, using established criteria of admission and welfare admissions in early August 1958. By September 8, 1959, it was apparent that unless more active measures were taken, the recruitment program for the hostels would be a failure, and it was urged that emergency measures be taken to step up the program of recruitment. When an aircraft arrived in a settlement, time must be allowed to persuade parents to let their children attend school by showing them the desirability of doing so. And in most instances, two flights into an area might be necessary, each containing an experienced administrator or education official. By September 18th, the Anglican hostel had 180 pupils registered, 182, Sari, and the RC Hospital 129. The federal school had 420 registered, with more students expected. The decision was made not to have a grand opening of all the facilities in Inuvik, but to have piecemeal openings of separate institutions. This decision was announced in October, but had obviously been implemented earlier in the case of the schools. By October 23rd, 245 pupils were expected to be enrolled in the non-denominational hostel, which must mean the Anglican hostel, but it's the first time I've seen that term, and 197 in the RC hostel. By March 1960, thought was being given to returning the first selection of children to their homes along the Arctic coast, which would take up, which would begin around May 15th, which would take place about May 15th, which would be a favorable time for flying in the Arctic. By November 5, 1959, the Roman Catholic hostel had constructed a skating rink with the aid of the Department of Public Works, the department having laid a gravel pad for that purpose, and the mission supplying the boards and some other material. Labor was performed by volunteers, and the rink is being used by the whole community. The priest in charge of the mission, supplied the materials for this rink. The mission hoped that the government would reimburse them for the cost of the material. Food in the meals in the Roman Catholic hostel as of October 25th, 1962, milk is offered four times a day and is a reconstituted whole and skim milk powder mixture. Fruit is offered once a day and often twice a day. Potatoes are served twice daily. Other vegetables are served once and sometimes twice daily. An observer recommends that vegetables be served twice daily and that these be frequently raw, if possible, so that children develop a taste for them. Bread and cereals. Children eat approximately 5 or 6 slices of bread daily. Margarine is spread on the bread. Whole grain cereal is served usually twice a week, and the observer recommends that it be served daily. Meat or meat alternates are served three times daily. That means beans, eggs, cheese, peanut butter for breakfast. Eggs are served 3 to 4 times a week. Cheese is served twice a week. Liver and heart once a week. And vitamin preparations are distributed daily. As far as the Anglican hostel is concerned, milk is served 3 times daily, with seconds being available. Reconstituted skim milk powder is used. Fruit or fruit juices are served at least twice daily, and usually oftener. Potatoes are served once daily. Other vegetables are served once and usually twice daily. Bread and cereals, 8 or 9 slices of bread are eaten daily as an average by each child. Margarine is used as a spread. A whole grain cereal is served about 6 days out of 7. Meat or meat alternates are served twice daily. Liver is served weekly. Eggs and cheese are served at least once weekly and sometimes twice. An observer recommends that these foods be served 3 times weekly. Vitamin preparations are also distributed. The observer notes that the food seems to be tasty and attractive. In addition, evening lunches are provided for senior students. Bread, margarine, and peanut butter, honey, or jam. 512 houses became available for purchase in 1959 November. At first, 5 and 16 were planned for purchase the following spring. In 1959 November, an estimate was also made of the number of permanent jobs that would be available in Inuvik. These total 225 in all federal establishments, and of these 225, it was thought that 98 would be filled by outside employees, and 127 would be available to local people. Of these 127 positions, 57 would require local people to secure additional training, and 70 would be available without additional training. Also in November 1959, building standards in the unserviced area were relaxed sufficiently to permit the people to put wooden roofs on their tents. And to make other small improvements, and this would be allowed only until 512 houses became available. By 1959, changes in the location of lots that had been originally allocated to Eklavik residents who came to Inuvik had also taken place. It's interesting to note that the unserviced area was originally set aside as a place where many local people would be building and occupying small houses without sewer and water connections and without elaborate foundations. Consequently, it was thought that this area would need good soil conditions, and the area set aside on the downstream half of the town site did contain the best soil conditions in the town site and was set aside for an unserviced area to be used by local people. A section at the end of edge of town was also set aside for larger lots which would allow a space for people owning dog teams to have space to tie the dog teams on their own land. Here also, frontier building standards were accepted as satisfactory. These are blocks 4 and 8. By October 6, 1959, thought was being given to finding available alternative building sites along the river channel. The rest of the town site, both serviced and unserviced, building standards conform to the National Building Code as amended to allow Plan 512 dwellings or the equivalent. Concerning lowering of standards beyond the frontier standard, an opinion was expressed that anybody who has permanent or semi-permanent employment should be able to meet the monthly payments for rigid frame or low-cost log housings, and marginal groups who could not afford such houses should be discouraged from settling permanently in the town of Inuvik, especially since Inuvik is not a good location for hunting, trapping, or fishing. Indians and Eskimo who wanted to continue this way of life would be better off in other locations. This opinion was expressed October 28, 1959. However, some thought was given to the possibility of establishing a transient area for seasonal residents somewhere near the frontier, near the dog trot, where the area where the dog teams were stationed, Block 8. But once an individual appeared to be settling there permanently, he should be induced to take better accommodations. It was agreed that it was stated that every step should be taken to eliminate the tent camp area, which would become easier as houses became available. In the frontier building standard area, wooden exteriors had to be painted, or in the case of log cabins, the logs had to be peeled and treated, or in any case, had to produce a satisfactory appearance. In September 1959, a proposal began to be heard to improve some of the roads in Old Iqaluit using shale, S-H-A-L-E, supply of which was located about 15 miles away. Also in September 1959, thought began to be given to the possibility that the standards in Inuvik might perhaps be too high for some of the population. Apparently this resulted from complaints of people who want the lowest type of accommodation built closer to the river. Perhaps we should even permit dwellers in tents to improve their premises for winter living by the addition of another roof to the tent. On the 26th of August, 1958, area development ordinance was declared for Inuvik becoming a development area site. As one of the provisions of this order, nobody could keep a dog in the area except in areas set aside with the approval of the site control officer. Plans for an Eskimo rehabilitation center to be located at the new site of Iqaluit and capable of accommodating 50 inmates with provision to extend this at a future date to provide for 100 inmates began to be heard in October 1955. Priority, however, was relatively low compared to a hospital, Roman Catholic and Anglican hostel, and a 25-room school. In 1960, plans for the kitchen, dining, washroom facilities for the rehabilitation center were drawn, and piles had begun to be installed for most of the 512 cabins that were moved to the site of such a center. In July 1961, construction on a kitchen complex was underway. A workshop, with the exception of a furnace room, had been completed. The installation of a furnace had been completed. Arts and craft shop, single men's quarters, single women's quarters, and four family quarters, and an office and two workhouses had been completed. Apparently, in July 1963, a rehabilitation center was in operation, and at that time, a request was made for the construction of four log cabins to accommodate the frequent people who come to Inuvik for training and retraining and have families. At present, at that time, only single persons could be accommodated, and families were billeted in welfare and other housing if available. According to a report in 1957, it was found that most of the privately owned buildings would not be worth moving from Iqaluit to the site of E3 because of their age or condition. However, the value of these buildings was determined for compensation purposes, the general principle being to establish fair value by determining the replacement cost under current conditions, less a reasonable deduction for depreciation, and an additional 15% for a disturbance allowance. The decision to move to the new site would be voluntary, although it was hoped that most of the local population would move. Where it was feasible to move buildings, this could be done. The owner would not only receive a foundation at the new site, but also a disturbance allowance amounting to 15% of the appraised value. Buildings that could not be moved would be transferred to the federal government, and the owner paid compensation equal to the appraised value plus a disturbance allowance. Such purchase and compensation would only be allowed when the owner intended to establish himself at the new town. Owners of lots would receive no compensation for their lots, but if these owners wish to move to the new town, then they must surrender the lot to the federal government and would receive a lot or lots sufficient for their needs at the new town. Residents of the old town who do not own lots there were entitled to receive free of charge a lot or lots sufficient for their needs at the new site. All these lots spoken about just now would be in the unserviced area, and the owners would have to bear the cost of utilities.